we can experience a great deal of hardship in this life. And how you respond to that hardship comes down to what you believe. So take, for example, Alexandre Dumas' story, The Count of Monte Cristo. In that story, there's this man named Edmond Dantès, and like Joseph, he is unjustly imprisoned. He's lied about. He's left to rot in the Chateau d'If. And like Joseph, also, he experiences this reversal of fortune so that he becomes this wealthy man. He becomes this man who's able to respond to those who have mistreated them. He's able to respond to those circumstances in accordance with his belief. Now, what does he believe? Well, at one point, Edmund, he's now disguised as the Count of Monte Cristo, he says, "An all-wise providence does not permit sinners to escape so easily from the punishment they have merited on earth." He believed that an all-wise providence, is terminology for God, wasn't going to let people get away with what they did. He was going to exact his revenge, his vengeance on those people in this life. And Dantès believed that he was God's instrument in order to exact that vengeance. Here's how he puts it. "Farewell, kindness, humanity, and gratitude. Farewell to all the feelings which expand the heart. Now the God of vengeance yields to me his power to punish the wicked." And so in the story, he spends all his time, all his energy getting back, taking revenge on those who mistreated him. And he does that based on his understanding of God and his providence. Now you might be tempted, you and I both might be tempted to respond to our circumstances that way. I mean, have you ever imagined your own Count of Monte Cristo version of revenge? Ever thought about what somebody did to you and what you would do if you had the power to do it? Have you ever thought about maybe rising the ladder and gaining providence over somebody who's trying to hold you back and just thinking about some maybe poetic justice or just flat out justice that you could carry out? Have you ever imagined that, daydreamed about that? Now, you might not have actually done any of that, but the question is, would you have? If you had the power to do it, if you had unchecked power, if you had the ability, nobody could stop you, what would you do to the people that mistreat you? Say farewell to kindness, to those feelings which expand the heart. How should we respond to mistreatment? It comes down to what we believe. Joseph, he experienced mistreatment, more mistreatment really than most people ever experience in this life. And his response really in the chapter we're going to look at is mind-blowing because of the position he's in Genesis 45. Joseph is one of the most powerful people on the earth at this time. But we don't see him responding with revenge. Why not? Because of what he believed about God's providence. What we believe about God and about his providence impacts. It has a tremendous impact on how we behave, on what we do. And that's what we're going to see this morning. You can turn there to Genesis chapter 45. There are seven parts to this story. And it's a way I've broken it down. And in these different parts, you see the impact that a belief in God's providence has. So what we're going to see is the belief in God's providence has seven products. Belief in God's providence produces gentleness, a narrative, confidence, forgiveness, influence, kindness, and hope. And as we make our way through that story, that's what we're going to see. We're going to see Joseph's revelation to his brothers first, and then God's kindness to his people, and then Joseph's plans for his father. And then at the center of this story, we see Joseph's reconciliation with his brothers. And then the second half works in reverse order. So we see Pharaoh's plans for Joseph's father, and then Joseph's kindness to his family, and then finally Joseph's revelation to his father. So before we get to that, though, before we get to these seven sections, we want to remember where we've been. We've been going through this last section of Genesis for the last few months. And we started with Joseph in the land of Canaan, and he was given these two dreams about his ascendancy over his brothers. And so partly because of those dreams, but even more so because of his father's favoritism, we find his brothers, they betray Joseph. They sell him into slavery. And his dad just thinks that he's been killed. He doesn't know about this slavery. So he's in Egypt, and he finds success in Potiphar's house because of God's presence with him. But then he's quickly betrayed by Potiphar's wife, and he's unjustly imprisoned. And while imprisoned, he interprets the dreams of two of Pharaoh's officials, and one of them, much later, ends up telling Pharaoh about him when Pharaoh had a dream that needed interpretation. And so after interpreting Pharaoh's dreams, he demonstrates this wisdom in response to that as well. Joseph is exalted to the second highest in command in Egypt. And those dreams were given to tell Pharaoh about the future, to tell him that there was going to be a seven-year experience of abundance, but that then there was going to be a seven-year famine that was going to swallow up that abundance so that it didn't matter, and that it was going to destroy Egypt, and not just Egypt, but the surrounding lands. And so just as God had foretold, those 7 years of abundance came, and then 2 years of the famine came. And those years of famine affected Joseph's family, and so Jacob sent his 10 of his sons to Egypt to get food. Now, when they arrived, Joseph recognized them. They didn't recognize him. And so that gave Joseph the opportunity to test them and to see if they were the same people that he had known when he last saw them. Now, just a few weeks ago, what we saw in chapter 44 was really the climax of that. The brothers demonstrated very clearly that they were repentant. So they're not the same terrible people who had thrown him into this pit and who had sold him into slavery. And they had demonstrated that by not responding the same way they did earlier when they were given the chance to do the same thing, this time to Benjamin, who was in the now the beneficiary of his father's favoritism. They didn't treat him the way that they treated Joseph. And so Joseph had seen this. So that's the point at which, in fact, Judah had been willing to sacrifice himself to take Benjamin's place so that the same thing that he had actually concocted decades earlier, so that that wouldn't take place. And that's what brings us to chapter 45. And the first of these seven parts is that Joseph's revelation to his brothers. Now put yourself in the brothers' shoes. Think about what they'd experienced. On their first trip to Egypt, they were accused of espionage. Not a good start. Then on the second trip, they have a party with their accuser. Everything seems great until they leave and they're chased after by his officials. And the youngest of them is accused of stealing his silver divination cup. This is the one that their father's prized son. And so Judah, he's pled for the sake of his brother, but there's been no response from Joseph yet. And so verse 1 says, "Then Joseph could not control himself before all those who stood by him. He cried, 'Make everyone go out for me.'" Now, what would you think at that point? I don't think you would think something good was about to happen. So Joseph's been keeping his emotions hidden. He's been very deliberate about that. He's been doing that because he doesn't want to let the cat out of the bag. He doesn't want his brothers to know who he is. So earlier, when they had admitted their great sin against him, he had to leave so that they wouldn't see him crying over that. And then when he saw Benjamin, his full brother, his only full brother, he had to leave again to keep them from seeing the emotions that he had for them. But now he doesn't need to hide his emotions. He doesn't even want to hide his emotions. He wants to stay in front of his servants. He wants to stay composed, but he wants to reveal to his brothers his emotions. He wants to open up to them. And so he sends all his servants out, every single one of them, so that he can make himself known to his brothers in private. So he can do that personally, intimately. Now, he's still not quiet. I mean, he's sobbing at this point, clearly loud enough that his servants, the Egyptians, they can hear it. And either Pharaoh is close enough to be able to hear it, their residents were that close, or he heard about it, it was passed along to him, but he would have heard this too. So again, imagine what the brothers are thinking. Joseph has not said anything up to this point. So this Egyptian lord has just ordered everyone out and he's sobbing in front of them. And Joseph then just blurts out, I am Joseph. Is my father still alive? Now, Judah had already said that his father was alive. But you know, that was when Judah thought he was talking to this Egyptian lord that was a stranger to him. Joseph could have thought, you know what? There might be more to the story. And if he knows that I'm Joseph, he might be willing to share that. But he also could have just been kind of expressing his shock that his father is alive. It's more of a rhetorical question. You know, can it be that my father really is still alive? That's his concern. That's what he wants. He wants that to know that this feeble man that Judah's just described is still alive. Verse 3 says, but his brothers could not answer him, for they were dismayed at his presence. This is the dismay that nations experience when they heard about what God did to Egypt when he redeemed them. That's what Exodus says. It uses this word. This is the dismay that Saul experienced when he saw Samuel's spirit in 1 Samuel 28:21. So this is not just some small response. This is terrifying to them. They're terrified. And so they can't say anything. Here's what they know. This Egyptian lord, he had been talking to them through an interpreter. There's no interpreter now. He's now speaking to them in their native language. No accent, with perfect fluency, and none of them had mentioned the name Joseph before. So there's every reason to believe he is who he says he is. But they stand there in shock, and so notice what Joseph does. He says, come near to me, please. He doesn't say, get over here. He's not upset. He's very polite with them. This is a very polite form of address. He asks them to please come closer to him. They're still speechless, but they do inch closer. And Joseph says very directly, I am your brother Joseph, whom you've sold into Egypt. Now there is, in all likelihood, complete shock on Benjamin's face. He had never heard this before. You never heard about him being sold into slavery. In fact, I think there's a good chance Reuben's like, what are you talking about? I am sure that these 9 or 10 sons of Jacob had been very tight-lipped about what they'd done. The only people that would have known what they did were themselves and one other person, and he just so happened, much to their chagrin, to be the guy standing there talking to them right then. So they're floored. But he's not harsh. He's gentle with them. Gentle with the guys who grabbed him and tore off his robe and threw him into a pit, into a dark, deep, empty cistern out in the middle of nowhere. These are the same guys that he watched as these slave traders put into their hands 20 shekels of silver. These are the same guys that very coldly, no doubt, looked away, just turned their backs as an iron collar, according to Psalm 105, was put around Joseph's neck. These are the guys that he is now treating gently. He has every opportunity to get them back. But he's responding with gentleness. Because belief in God's providence produces gentleness. Belief in the providence of the God of the Bible, that is. So if you don't know that God, like Edmond Dantès clearly did not in that story, this response might not follow. But Joseph knows this God whose mysterious providence is at work in everything that he experiences. So when people who have mistreated him are there in front of him and he can do something about it, it's his belief in God's providence that keeps him from being harsh. It allows him, it produces in him gentleness. So after Joseph revealed his identity to his brothers, we see God's kindness to his people in verses 5 through 8. Joseph explains this kindness to his brothers. It's the kindness of God's providence. That's what he's talking about. Joseph has come to understand this through his life, through his experiences. He's come to understand this because he understands what he's gone through and where he is now. It's not happenstance. It's not just a series of random events. This is exactly what God had told them about back in chapter 37. So this is God's kindness that he's been working out for the sake of his people. So Joseph follows this bombshell of a revelation quickly by saying, "And now do not be distressed or angry with yourselves because you sold me here." He doesn't want them to be upset. He doesn't want them to be unnerved by his revelation. But the question is, how are you going to convince these guys to do that? They know the situation. They know the power that Joseph has. They know what they did, and they feel guilty about it. How is he going to convince them not to be upset? God's providence. So he says, "God sent me before you to preserve life." That's how Joseph interpreted his experience. His brothers sold him into slavery. He's very clear about that. That's very true. But just as true is the fact that God is the one who sent him to Egypt. And God had that greater purpose, to preserve life. He's not denying either purpose. He's not trying to explain it either. The brothers really did intend to sell him into slavery. But concurrent with that intention was God's intention to send him to Egypt to preserve life. He's not working this out. There's no attempt to do that ever in the Bible. There's just this assumption. In the Old Testament especially, you see that both of these realities are true. So Proverbs 16:9 says, "The heart of man plans his way, but the Lord establishes his steps." Proverbs 19:21 says, "Many are the plans in the mind of a man, but it is the purpose of the Lord that will stand." So we are responsible for what we do. That's never a question in the Bible. But nothing we could ever do could ever stop God from accomplishing his plans. As John Walton puts it, "The depths of God's sovereignty are not demonstrated by his repression of our choices that inevitably reveal our sinfulness and fallen self-will, but by the fact that there is no choice that we can make, however sinful or fallen, that can interfere with his plan." See, the fact of the matter is, before we're even born, God has already planned everything that we will experience. That is why Psalm 139:16 says, "Your eyes saw my unformed substance. In your book were written every one of them, the days that were formed for me, when as yet there was none of them." And yet Romans 2:6 says, "He will render to each one according to his works." God plans our steps, but we are still absolutely responsible for what we freely choose to do. God is not holding us responsible for something he forces us to do. We carry out our intentions, and yet his plans continue unabated, unhindered. And you say, I don't understand how that can be true. You really have a couple choices. You can trust in your philosophical prowess to work that out, or you can believe what the Bible teaches. If you believe in this understanding of God's providence, it will transform the way that you view your circumstances. So look at what Joseph says here. First of all, he believes what God has revealed about the future. So the 7 years of plenty, they've come and gone, and there's been a famine for 2 years, and so Joseph states confidently, without hesitation, in verse 6, "There are yet 5 years in which there will be neither plowing nor harvest." He believes, absolutely, there's going to be 5 more years of famine, because he believes in God's providential control of everything that happens. Secondly, he's viewing his own circumstances from this providence. So he's already said it, but he's going to repeat it over and over again. What he's already said about this, he repeats it in 7 and 8. He says, "God sent me here before you to preserve for you a remnant on earth and to keep alive for you many survivors. So it was not you who sent me here, but God." The ultimate reason why he is in Egypt is God. God sent him to preserve people, to preserve his people So his brothers really didn't send him to Egypt, right? That wasn't their intention. He could have been headed to, those slave traders, they could have been headed to Mesopotamia for all they cared. That wasn't their intention. Their intention wasn't to send him to Egypt. God sent him to Egypt. God is the only one who did that. Their actions brought it about. God was sending him to Egypt. God was the one who made Joseph Pharaoh's chief advisor. That was the idea of making him a father to Pharaoh. God is the one who made him lord over Pharaoh's house and ruler over the land of Egypt. This is how Joseph sees his situation. This is how he sees his circumstances. This is the lens through which he views his life. And understand what he's describing here. This is the terminology in Genesis that's reminiscent of the flood and Noah, the preservation of life. This is the kind of terminology where God is preserving a remnant and survivors. That's what the prophets are going to use to describe what God does for Israel in the future. This is speaking of God's overarching plan to preserve a people for himself. That's what Joseph is a part of. He recognizes that. It's not a series of random events. This is God's bigger purpose. He's part of something big. He's a part of what God's doing in the world. That's how he views his circumstances. So it's common for people today to talk about a narrative. And we talk about narratives. People are talking about a way of presenting or understanding a situation that promotes a certain values or a certain way of viewing them. So you hear people in politics talk about a Republican narrative or a Democratic narrative or the media's narrative, right? When people talk about that, they're not really suggesting that those people's narrative is just a direct lie. That's the way that people are understanding their circumstances. This is the way that they're kind of pulling everything together and understanding it more comprehensively. This is how they put everything together so that they can make sense out of it. That's what the narrative is supposed to do. Well, belief in God's providence produces a narrative. It's the true narrative. It's the true lens through which you should view your life, how you should make everything make sense. The truth behind the truth, the unseen reality behind it all. When you believe in God's providence, you're going to look at your situation differently than people who don't believe in God's providence. And this narrative, that's what allows you to be gentle with people who mistreat you. And that's what allows you, by its impact, to do the other things that we're going to see here with Joseph. So after Joseph explains God's kindness to his people, to his brothers, he goes on to share his impact or the impact of God's providence on his plans for his father. And so in verses 9 through 13, you see Joseph's plans for his father. He immediately begins to tell his brothers what they need to do, how they need to respond based on God's providence, based on what God is doing. They're supposed to rush back to the land of Canaan and convince their father to come live with them, live with him in Egypt. So he gives this message to pass along in verses 9 through 11. He refers to himself as your son, Joseph. And then he talks about this good news that God had made him lord over all Egypt and that Jacob should waste no time in getting everything, collecting all of his family and his belongings and coming to see him. He says, you and your children, or you could read your sons. So he's including his brothers in this. And your children's children and your flocks, your herds, and all that you have. And he tells them why they need to do this urgently, because he believes that there are 5 more years of famine. So Jacob needs to come, and he has every reason, every incentive to come, because Joseph doesn't want him to lose everything. See, in an agrarian society, wealthy people are wealthy because of their cattle, their herds. But in a famine, your wealth is decimated. You lose everything. Your animals die. And he doesn't want him to lose everything. And so Joseph then encouraged his brothers with the proof that they've seen. He turns to look at them and he says, you know that this is true. You've now seen me talking. They're witnesses to the fact that Joseph is alive and that he's in charge in Egypt. And even Benjamin can point this out to their father if they don't trust the brothers, which he would have very little reason to trust them. Now, how can Joseph be so decisive? How can he presume to know what's best for other people? God had revealed his providential plan to Joseph, and Joseph believed it. So he wasn't just exerting some human wisdom here. He was taking what God had revealed, and he was applying a divine wisdom. He wasn't confident in himself because he'd been successful in Egypt. Belief in God's providence produces confidence, not in yourself, but in God. Now, Christians, we can come across as arrogant, can't we? Like when we presume to know what people should do. That honestly can come across as arrogant. I mean, what right should we have? Why should we think that our truth should define somebody else's life? Why should we think that? Because it's not our truth. It's not our truth. We believe that what we believe is God's truth. And that's why we can have confidence that we know what is what we should do. We should listen to God, not just listen to what other people claim is their truth. That is what's best for other people. It sounds arrogant. It'll be misunderstood. But it's where our confidence comes, because we believe that God is sovereign over everything that happens. In the midst of this chaos, we believe that God's on his throne. We believe that in the end, we're all going to stand before him. We believe that to such an extent that we care about people enough to know what's in their best interest, even if they don't know what's in their best interest. Even if we risk coming across as arrogant, isn't it worth it to show, to point them to what is truly their good? To not give in to this climate where it's all about individual truths? All other truths are fantasy apart from the truth. So, we can have that confidence. It's a confidence based on God's word. It's a confidence because we believe in God's providence. And that providence actually produces confidence. So finally we reach the center of the story where we see Joseph's reconciliation with his brothers. It's found in verses 14 and 15. Verse 14 says, "Then he fell upon his brother Benjamin's neck and wept. And Benjamin wept upon his neck." So this is an emotional reunion of two brothers. I mean, you can understand. Joseph has been informed that this was going to happen. He had his dreams. And he's been seeing them play out. He's been seeing God fulfilling those dreams. But this was still decades. And so you can imagine just the being overwhelmed by the fact that it's finally here. Now, Benjamin, on the other hand, Benjamin, it's like he has just received his brother back from the dead. He's overwhelmed because of that. Now what Joseph does next, he brings about reconciliation with his brothers, that the people had mistreated him. Verse 15 says that he not only wept over Benjamin, but he also kissed all his brothers and wept upon them. And his genuineness was evident enough that it says that after this, his brothers talked with him. You know, they've been dumbstruck up to this point. They couldn't speak, but when they saw what Joseph did, the way that he responded to them, they could see enough of the genuineness that they could then speak to him, really speak to him. Now, they're going to struggle. They're going to struggle with guilt. They're going to struggle with fear in chapter 50. But they are seeing this genuineness in Joseph, and they're able to actually talk to him. What Joseph's doing here, this is a display of forgiveness. He's in a position, again, to take revenge. He has the power to treat them the way that they've treated him. He doesn't have to have a trial. You remember what happened with Potiphar. Potiphar just throws him in prison. What did Joseph do when they got there? He threw him in prison. It's not like there's some legal means that he has to do. He could do whatever he wants to them without recourse. So he could have done that, but he doesn't do it. He forgives them. How do you do that? How do you keep from pulling an Edmond Dantes and getting back in people when you finally are in power to do that? It comes down to what you believe. And Joseph believed in God's providence. Belief in God's providence produces forgiveness. When you know that God's at work, even in the evil that people do to you, you can forgive people who wrong you. And you could say, you could look at this and say, well, I mean, look at Joseph's situation. Look at the position he's in. I mean, it'd be easy to forgive people if you're like Joseph. But understand, you have to look at our situation with the right perspective. We're headed for the same position. It's as good as happened. It's as Paul puts it in 2 Timothy 2:12. If we endure, we will also reign with him. Joseph's experience is actually a picture of what we'll experience. It's not even as great as what we'll experience. We're going to experience reigning with Christ over the world. Greater than Joseph's experience. So, when you believe that God's at work in everything, the good and the bad, you don't have to hold things against people. God is going to hold them accountable. He will take care of what they've done. But what they did was also part of his plan for you. What they did was part of what God was doing for your good. We know the passage well, right? Romans 8:28 says, and we know that for those who love God, all things work together for good. For those who are called according to his purpose. What's the good? What is his purpose? He says in the next verse. Verse 29 says, for those whom he foreknew, he also predestined to be conformed to the image of his son. We suffer like Jesus so that we'll become like Jesus. That's what God's doing. Through the evil that people do to you, he is making you more like Jesus. He is causing you to experience the very things that his son went through so that you can be like him. So that you can be like the one who reconciles us with God, making us ministers of reconciliation. You can only do that when you forgive. So who is it that you can't forgive? They're an instrument of God. It's not pleasant. I'm not saying it's pleasant. It's not something we enjoy. That doesn't change the fact that they are actually an instrument that God is using in your life to beautify you, to chip away at your sin, to make you into the image of Jesus. Starting in verse 16, we start to work backwards. And so Joseph gives his plans for his father earlier. And now in verses 16 through 20, we have Pharaoh's plans for Joseph's father. And they really just confirm Joseph's plans. So verse 16 says that Pharaoh and his household, they heard that Joseph's brothers had come. And it says they were pleased at that. Both Pharaoh and his servants, his officials. They had no idea what Joseph's brothers had done to him. They're just looking at this situation and they are happy for Joseph for this family reunion. I mean, Joseph had just rescued their entire nation from destruction. So they're happy for him. And so Pharaoh tells them to pack up and head back to the land of Canaan and to get their father and the rest of their family and come back to Pharaoh so that he can give them what he says is the best of the land of Egypt. He says they will eat the fat of the land. He's making it very clear just how welcome they are. They need to come back. They're going to be taken care of. They have nothing to worry about. And then Pharaoh gives some orders to Joseph to tell his brothers to take wagons from the land of Egypt for their little ones and for their wives and for their father. They're to use them to bring them back to Egypt. And he adds that they don't have to worry about any of the belongings that they can't bring with them. He's not saying that they can't have any belongings, but if they have to leave them behind, they'll be able to replace them with even better things in Egypt, because he says, the best of all the land of Egypt is yours. Now think about this. Why is Pharaoh doing this? Because he likes Joseph. Joseph is what God had used to save his country. Joseph's life had an impact on him. It had influenced him. Now, we may not be used by God. In fact, we likely will not be used by God to provide a monetary or material benefit to the people around us. That was not what God has promised us. But understand, God had promised Abraham that he would bless those who had blessed him. And that's what you see with the patriarchs. We saw it with Jacob and Laban. We saw it with Joseph. Joseph in Potiphar's house. And then Joseph in prison. And now in Egypt. This is what we see. This is a promise to the patriarchs that God would bless the people who'd blessed him. So that was their promise. What have we been told about our influence on other people? Jesus said that our influence is our good works. And he said that the people around us would see those good works. They would see the righteousness of the kingdom. They would see this gospel transformation. And they would glorify God. I think Jesus is talking about conversion there. So when we show to the people around us that we are following Jesus, we can influence the people around us. And we can do that when we believe that God is at work. Through us, God is at work in all things. It's belief in God's providence that produces influence. You're not going to be confident enough to live your life as a Christian before others if you are not equally confident that God is at work in every little thing. But when you believe that, then you can have an influence on the people around you. Now, we saw God's kindness to Joseph's family earlier. And now in verses 21 through 24, we see Joseph's kindness to his family. So his brothers and Joseph, they listen to Pharaoh. And Joseph gives wagons to his brothers. But he goes beyond that. You see what he does there in verses 21 through 24. He gives them provisions for the journey. So he's taking care of them. And he adds to that gifts. And these are the kinds of gifts that people gave in that day. People didn't have a lot of changes of clothing. So the clothes that they wore were often worn out. And so it was nice. A change of clothes was a very nice gift. And it was the exact opposite of the treatment that he'd received. The direction of transfer of clothing was in the opposite direction. They had stripped him of his clothes. He's giving them clothes. Now, Joseph does give Benjamin more. He gave this brother who had never betrayed him 300 shekels of silver and 5 changes of clothes. And he gave his dad 20 donkeys, 10 male donkeys loaded with the good things of Egypt, and then 10 female donkeys loaded with grain, bread, and provisions for his father on the journey. Jacob has every incentive to come with this gift. But I think the last thing that Joseph does in verse 24, it sounds abrupt, but I think it's one of the most kind things that he does. As he's sending them away, he says, "Do not quarrel on the way." That's what the ESV translates. I think the NET is probably closer to what Joseph's intention were. The NET translates it, "Don't be overcome with fear." It's how that word is often translated. So, think about the last two times they left Egypt. They left Egypt and then they discovered, oh man, we've got all the money that we sent. So that every time they leave Egypt, it's like their stomach just drops. And then they left the second time and they're chased after by these Egyptian officials. I think what Joseph is doing is say, you don't need to worry this time. It's all over. All these things that you've experienced, these games, these tricks, they're not happening. You don't need to fear. That's a very thoughtful thing to do. Just to comfort them. You could imagine wanting to just kind of leave them in a little bit of tension. Yeah. Let them leave and then be maybe worried that something bad was going to happen. He doesn't do that. So, where does this kind of kindness come from? How's a guy who is so mistreated treat the very people who mistreated him this way with gifts, with thoughtfulness? It comes down to what you believe. Belief in God's providence produces kindness. He hadn't bid farewell to kindness like Dantes had. It was actually through his correct belief in God's providence that that Joseph is able to treat his brothers in ways that they did not treat him. That's very hard to do, isn't it? The most natural reflex we have is to consider, well, this is what I experienced, and so I'm glad this person's experiencing it too. Or I want this person to have to go through what I went through. That is the most natural thing in the world. Well, I had to put up with it. You know where I struggle with it? With my kids. Yeah. Well, this is what my parents did with me. And it worked out. You know, and there are good things that happen. Good things happen with Joseph. He went through this difficult thing, and it taught him, it produced in him a maturity. There are good things, there are benefits to what he went through, but he doesn't do that in return. He doesn't say, well, you know, it was good for me, it was good for them. He understands that God was at work in it. God was at work in the difficulty. God was at work at the problem, but he doesn't respond with that. He responds with kindness. God's providence freed him from that kind of cold karma that we think about for other people. Well, when I was in that situation, that's what I had to go through. So, no, he's kind. His belief in God's providence freed him so that he could be kind to the people who were unkind to him. That's the way we need to be. We should never do as we've been done. No, we do to others what we would like them to do to us. That's what Jesus told us in Matthew 7. Last thing we see in this chapter is where we began. We began with Joseph's revelation to his brothers, and in the end, in verses 21 through 28, we have Joseph's revelation to his father through his brothers. So his brothers get back to Canaan and they tell their dad in verse 26, Joseph is still alive. He is ruler over the land of Egypt. Jacob has no way to receive this, to accept this. So it says his heart became numb for he did not believe them. He's unmoved because he's unable to believe these deceitful sons. But they don't give up. They go on to tell him what Joseph told them to tell him. They share Joseph's message. And as Joseph hears those words, or as Jacob hears those words, and as he looks at these Egyptians, very clearly Egyptian wagons, text says his spirit revived. You know, it was like that part of him that died when he heard the news about his son. That part came back alive. That's what we see here. And so his response then really is to reverse what he says at the end of chapter 37 when he first heard that news. Remember, his children tried to comfort him in verse 35 said, but he refused to be comforted and said, no, I shall go down to Sheol to my son mourning. He thought his reunion with Joseph was going to be after he died. But their evidence was enough. He says here, his son is alive. And then he states with resolve, I will go and see him before I die. Now, you know, what did he believe? Well, the words of Joseph were all about God's providence. That's what Joseph was telling him. He was telling about what God had done. And Jacob had already seen this. Jacob has seen that God works through this mysterious providence. He saw it when he was heading to Mesopotamia. He'd seen the way that God had kept his promise to him and brought him safely back to Canaan. This is old territory for Jacob. And now once again, God had done it. He had kept his word. What word? That dream. Jacob heard that dream. He heard that. He didn't believe it then. Now he did. Now he believed. Now he had hope. Not the way that we use that word, that biblical hope. He has this confident expectation. Belief in God's providence produces hope. When you believe that God really is in charge, when you believe that God is in control, then you know what he says he will do, and you can set your hope on him without reservation. Now, it's not just Joseph and Jacob who can have this confidence. Now, we can't have confidence that God is going to bring about our good because we're the physical descendants of Abraham. We're not. Well, There's at least one person who is. But we can have confidence, and all of us can have confidence, because Joseph's life pointed to something, pointed forward. Joseph was a suffering servant of God. So in God's providence, he was mistreated so that God's people would be delivered. He was made a slave. He was rejected. He was maligned. He was unjustly punished. And it was all so that in the end, he would be exalted to a place where he could rescue God's people, the people of Israel. The name mentioned there in verse 28. Israel receives back his son. He believed his son to be dead. This was like receiving his son back from the dead. He was alive, and he was Lord of Egypt. You know, Jesus came as a suffering servant for God's people. He experienced mistreatment so that they could experience deliverance. He became a slave by giving up the honor he had as God to become a human. He was slandered and maligned. He was rejected. He was unjustly punished. And it was all so that by his exaltation, he could rescue his people. He had actually died. But he is alive. And he is Lord. How does he save? By his forgiveness, by his sacrifice, by his resurrection. Who does he save? Everyone who recognizes that they need to be saved from their sin. And who believes that he is alive and that he is Lord. And they show it by following him. And if that's not you, I would urge you to respond that way today. For those who have responded to that good news, then unlike what the Count of Monte Cristo says, farewell to vengeance. That's what we say. God, the God of providence, yields to us by faith the power to be gentle with those who wrong us, to view our lives with the true narrative, to be confident in our obedience, to forgive those who wrong us, to influence the people around us for him, for his cause, to be kind and to hope in him. That's what God's providence produces in us by his Spirit when we believe it. Join me in prayer. Father, there are many things in this life that can rock our world. They can throw us. We can struggle with how do we respond. It's difficult. The emotions are real. The pain is real. We can see a story like this, and sometimes it's hard for us to see that it's not just a story. This is reality. And we know that we need your grace to do that. We ask that you would give us this lens through which we could view our circumstances, that we would know this is not just a story. This is reality, that we would live in this reality, that we would know that you are in charge, that we would live in light of your providence so that we can be gentle with those who wrong us, kind to them, forgive them, so that we can be confident when we hear your word and obey it in spite of the fact that there are other narratives out there. There are other truths that people want to present, that we can have confidence, not in ourselves, not in our own successes, not in our own ability, not in our own intellect. That we know by your Son and by your Spirit, we know that you are on your throne, that what you say is good, that we would listen to it and follow you, knowing that no matter what happens to us, it is all according to your plan. It is for our good. The good and the bad that we face is for our good, that we would believe that. We would recognize that you are conforming us into the image of your Son. That would be what enables us to forgive, what enables us to be kind and gentle, even to people that act like our enemies. We would show love to them. the way that you have shown love to us. Father, for anyone who is not turning from their sin, doesn't recognize their need to be rescued from their sin, isn't living like they believe that Jesus is Lord, that he is alive, that the resurrection is real, that they would, by your Spirit, they would see that they would respond with repentance, with faith, they would follow Jesus, they would do what he says, unashamed to follow their Lord and Savior. Ask God, because of your grace, because of your mercy in your Son,